Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by the Isley Brothers, the Carpenters, the Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts. Please consider supporting Black Women United YEG for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. You can learn more about them at bwunited.ca. They are always looking for donations and volunteers. So please, again, support Black Women United YEG for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. Again, that website is bwunited.ca.
Hi, I'm Jed Bodwin, and I live in Wichita, Kansas. I am a Patreon supporter for Creative Control. I discovered Creative Control some years ago, I think maybe while looking for interviews with Tommy Stinson of The Replacements. And I stumbled across this conversation that Vish had with Tommy Stinson that was really insightful. Vish held his own. I think Tommy can be a little bit of a difficult interview at times. And it went really well, and it really got into some areas that I wasn't expecting. And I thought, gosh, I have to listen to more of this guy and his podcast. Yeah, sometimes I'm not necessarily a fan of the music or musicians that Vish will have on the show, but I always appreciate their creative process a little bit more. And more times than not, though, it does lead me to finding a new musical artist that I'm interested in, or to think a little bit differently about maybe some artists whose work I've overlooked. So, you know, go ahead, and if you've been waiting at all to support Vish and Creative Control, now is probably the best time to do it. I know as a public radio employee here in Kansas, listener-supported broadcasting, whether it's podcasts or radio itself, really isn't a thing of the past. It's actually very much a thing of both the present and the future. So, yay Vish, yay Creative Control.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today.
Jeff Tweedy is a brilliantly talented songwriter, producer, author, multi-instrumentalist, and singer based in Chicago, Illinois. Shortly after the dissolution of his other influential band, Uncle Tupelo, Tweedy formed Wilco in 1994, leading that band through a remarkable trajectory of Grammy-winning and innovatively idiosyncratic rock, folk, and country music sounds, compellingly haunting lyricism, and one of the greatest live music shows in history. Wilco's 12th album is a double LP called Cruel Country, which was released on May 27th, 2022, via their own DBPM label, and it prompted Jeff and I to reconnect to have a lovely and in-depth conversation about Wilco's Solid Sound Music Festival, arts curation, and other cultural endeavors, the pros and cons of contributing to a communicative exchange of ideas and feelings in a heightened age of opinion sharing, criticism, indifference, and negative bias, when certain people die, and death generally, abstractions and specific genre signifiers, whether fashionability still exists, his book, How to Write One Song, and also the specific B-52 song, The Love Shack, the state and stasis of the United States of America, the 11-LP anniversary box set for the 2002 Wilco album Yankee Hotel Foxtrot, other future plans, and much more. A part of the Entertainment One Network with the support of listeners like you who follow and subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol with additional support from Blackbird Music, a well-stocked record store with locations in Edmonton and Calgary, Alberta, and friendly staff who will happily help you fulfill whatever orders you need. Hey, what if you're like, I want the new Wilco album, Cruel Country, or maybe I want other Wilco albums? Just go to blackbird.ca and see if they can't help you out with that. Plus, in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario. This is episode 692 of Creative Control, featuring the lovely and talented Jeff Tweedy of Wilco, with your host, me, Vish Khanna. I lose it. My heart's hard to find. Hi, Jeff. How you doing?
Good. How you doing, Vish?
I'm well. It's nice to speak with you again. First of all, where in the world are you today?
I'm in Michigan, a small place over in Michigan, about an hour and a half away from Chicago.
Oh, nice. Just relaxing, are you?
Yeah, like just got home from Solid Sound Festival and just getting a little hiking in, trying to get a little, I don't know, I think it's traveling, I always feel a little bit safer separating myself from my family for a few days just to make sure that I don't get my wife sick because she's maybe a little bit immunocompromised. So just kind of doing a little quick quarantine.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, that makes sense. How, your family's well otherwise? Everyone's good?
Yeah.
Okay. Good, good. That's great. How is Solid Sound? I saw some news footage and things about it. How was it for you?
It was the best one ever. It was incredible. I mean, we really loved our lineup this year. So just so many things that we felt excited to get to share with people.
Yeah, the news things I'm referring to included, I think, Nels playing with Japanese Breakfast. And then David Byrne. Did you perform with David Byrne somehow?
David Byrne contacted us because he was coming to see Terry Allen, who's he's buddies with Terry Allen. And I asked him if he wanted to sit in, and he said he would like to love to sing California Stars with me.
Oh, so
with
gosh.
Us, we did that. And Michelle Zahner played Jesus Etc. with us in our set on the Saturday night also. So yeah, there were a little bit less, you know, collaborations than in the past, just because we were being pretty careful about keeping people, I don't know, just not mixing it up as much as we have in the past, just for testing purposes and all that stuff. But
yeah.
We did get some visits on stage together, so it was nice.
It sounded great. I hope I can attend. This is in Massachusetts, right?
It's in North Adams, Massachusetts at Mass MoCA, which is an incredible contemporary art museum on the campus of a 19th century, 18th century factory that was a textile mill that became a capacitor factory for Sprague Electronics in the, you know, mid-century, and then eventually went out of business for that due to nanotechnology. So just the whole history of capitalism in one spot.
Well, that's an interesting segue into my follow-up question, because as it stands, and correct me if I'm wrong, Wilco has its own label, own recording studio, and then between Solid Sound and now Sky Blue Sky, you have at least, if that's a regular thing, then you've got two music festivals. Am I missing something? Is that accurate?
That's pretty, yeah. You know, Sky Blue Sky is more of a hand curated festival that, you know, that we initiated. That's Solid Sound. I'm sorry. Sky Blue Sky is more kind of a destination package kind of festival that was kind of presented to us as something we could participate in, that other bands do similar things. And they're both very fun, but they're very different in terms of what our overall involvement is, but we love doing both of them.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, I'm based on what I was just describing, the motivation I'm guessing is to have fun, because music is fun and you get to put things together and put records out and all that stuff. So it's fun, but I think they're also fairly savvy business things. Like, how important is it for you to have ownership as an artist over such things? Because Lord knows we have a lot of festivals. So you put your hat in the ring, and I assume that's because you think the same way I put my hats in various rings. I think I can maybe contribute to this and make it maybe just a little bit better, maybe. But I also feel like I enjoy that so much. Wouldn't it be nice to do my own version of that thing? So I assume that's all swimming around. But is the ownership part important to you too?
Well, I mean, when we started this Solid Sound Festival, there weren't that many festivals. I mean, there were starting to be more, but it was really kind of modeled more on the smaller sort of Scandinavian festivals that we had played in the 90s on, you know, a lot of the fall festivals in smaller countries in Europe tend to be on college campuses during, you know, some sort of winter break or things like, you know, they're a little bit unique compared to what we think of as a festival in the United States, which is big outdoor summertime, hot, sweaty, massive crowd kind of festival. We didn't think that was in the cards for us, but it was pretty exciting to do something that was more, I don't know, focused and small.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, in the years since we started it, it's an explosion of festivals. Seems like there are like hundreds of them compared to when we started. And as far as like ownership, I mean, it was just a whim, really. It was just like, kind of like, is this the thing we can do? And we tried it. And then the first one felt like a really, I don't know, if you're into Wilco, it's kind of like the broadest expression of what Wilco represents, because it doesn't just incorporate our music. It incorporates the music we love and the art we love and the comedians we love and the community itself plays a strong role in communicating something communal.
Yeah. I think the curatorial thing though, it seems to me you have that impulse. Like, wouldn't it be nice? Maybe ownership was the wrong word, because I'm sure we've all seen a festival lineup announcement and thought, oh, that's, I feel like most people are like, it sucks. No matter who's playing, they just, 50 bands, who cares? It sucks. And you're like, what? There's got to be 5% of this lineup that you think is fine. Sorry, I talked to lots of angry Canadians. So I'm like, really? You're that is, okay, there must be something there you like. And then, but then, as you start getting, for me or others who get involved in these things, then you realize, oh my God, what a rigmarole infrastructurally to put this puzzle together of a festival. No wonder those people are stressed out and doing their best, you know, to fit all these people in. But all I'm getting at, though, is curatorially, it's fun. I know that it can be fun to be like, wouldn't it be great if I could just put together the lineup I love? So I'm sure, do you have that impulse? Like, are you hands-on yourself, Jeff, in putting it together?
Absolutely. It's, I'm already, you know, compiling a list of hopeful suggestions for next time, you know, which we do it every other year for the Solid Sound Festival.
Yeah.
Partially to kind of keep it interesting and not have it be too much of, I don't know, it takes a lot of energy for our, it's a small organization. I mean, our, our whole organization is probably smaller than, you know, a lot of bigger bands, but in general, it's all hands on deck to put this whole thing together. And it takes a lot of, you know, a lot of hours of our time. So we try and do it every other year. And, it does feel great to get, it feels really validating to me to have like a huge dream of some artist coming to play and them saying yes. And I mean, I know we're paying them. I know that we try to make it work, but we've actually gotten bigger artists than we probably deserve to have, because there are a fair amount of people that just want to do it because they've heard that it's a good environment and a friendly space to be able to make a musical statement.
Well, I mean, I think it also is an extension of you just sharing your love of artists. Like, it's more than sharing a playlist or whatever. It's actually being like, look, like, we love these people so much. Because I think you probably also recognize that you have influence over your fans, and on some level, like, I'm sure you don't think about it that much in any draconian way, but to make a recommendation to your fans, I'm sure that must be exciting for you to be like, yeah, you love us, check out so-and-so. Like, is that there as well?
Absolutely. It's an incredible position to be put in. And we definitely, as a band, benefited from people sharing their stages with us. You know, we asked to go out and open for Neil Young or for REM and countless others. I mean, just that was a generous thing mm-hmm. for them to do, mm-hmm. to share their audience, to put us in front of people that might like us. And that definitely is a consideration for our festival. I know that there are people, I've seen testimonials to this fact, you know, that people have come and they've never heard of a certain amount of the, you know, artists that are going to be there, and they leave having a new favorite or a couple of new favorites. Yeah. And that's really satisfying. And it's, I think there should be more of it in general. I think that artists tend to be pretty isolated and maybe a little bit guarded about their influences sometimes, but most of the people that I really love, when you get them going, they have this undiminished curiosity about the world and music, and they have lots and lots of suggestions to make of things that they've discovered, and they add, you know, they're generous with that knowledge.
Yeah, well, for what it's worth, I appreciate it. I appreciate your, I think, you know, for what it's worth, I think you and I are aligned in so many aesthetic interests that I appreciate the things that you get behind. If that, for what that's worth, it is appreciated. And by that token, I'd like to congratulate you on this new record, Cruel Country. It's wonderful. I hope you're very proud of it. I hope you, all I'm saying is I think you should be really proud of it.
I am really proud of it. I love it. I love it. The band loves it. We love the record, and we're really, really, you know, we're going through that weird moment right after you put a record out into the world where it feels like you're becoming aware of the fact that you've picked out a present for some people that are just going to go, I would never wear anything like that. You know, just to use a weird analogy, it's like a really considered gift. It's a really thoughtful thing that we love. And like most gifts that you think that somebody is going to love, and you're sure, how could somebody not love this? You think that because you love it so much. We love it so much that the inevitable criticisms that come with any single record ever put out, or even the indifference of it, is a little bit like, makes you feel a little bit like you wish you could just keep the present that you
why did I
you ever bought some present that you just want to keep after you see their reaction to it?
Yeah, I never thought of it that way, but yes, now that you mention it, I think so. Yeah. Yeah, well, I hope.
Well, you put out books, right?
No, I haven't actually put out any books. People ask me if I should, are you putting out a book? And I say, no, I haven't done that yet.
Well, okay. Well, you put things out into the world.
Every week I put one of these things out. Yeah, absolutely.
And so you see reactions that are, let's just say, less than given in the spirit that you're putting it out there?
Well, I'll tell you this, like, you know, external considerations are, you know, we're in a don't read the comments zone. But I will tell you, mm-hmm. and this is no pressure on you by any stretch, but the rejection I feel is usually when a guest and I have a nice encounter, maybe there's some follow-up messaging. This just happened to me, so it's on my mind. Comedians, they don't tend to share the stuff. And I'm like, oh, I shared you with my audience. Why? And it sounds petty. I don't want to sound petty. I'm just saying that's where it gets heartbreak. I'm like, oh, because that's it. If 50 people who weren't involved in it tell me they hate it, I'm like, okay, that's your opinion. That doesn't happen, by the way. I'm fine. But if the guest doesn't engage with it, or I hear later, like, oh, I wish I hadn't said that. Because that's what this is, right? It's a lot of sharing people talking, and people get self-conscious about what they said, particularly these days. So, oh my God, mm-hmm. I'm on the record sounding like an idiot. I'm not sharing that. I get that part, but nothing. Mm-hmm. That's where it hurts. And I just had, I've had this good run of people sharing and loving and sending the guests. I mean, sending these lovely notes. Had a couple comedians mm-hmm. on recently. Nothing. And again, nice emails. Everything's good. No, I'll never know why they didn't do it, because it's insane to be like, hey, how come you didn't share the thing? I look like a lunatic and I don't want to do that. So I'm just telling you how I feel.
You mean like sharing on their social media, like that they were on the show?
I guess so. I mean, to me, that's the really like, yes, that is what I'm getting at. But to me, it's more like sharing it with the people that love you. That's the way I look at it. It doesn't mean like it does help. Sometimes that's how things get shared these days. And the word gets spread. Mm-hmm. But that's where that hurts more. What I'm saying is people can leave horrible comments, but that doesn't bother me as much as the actual person I engage with not engaging or saying that something bothered them about it. That would hurt me way more. And I imagine you might, if someone in the band told you, Wilco said, you know, I know we put this record up. I'm not so sure. Like that would probably bother you more than like some critic saying, oh, you know, I'm guessing. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm just trying to make mental note of what's going to be required of me after this is over.
No, sorry. No pressure. You don't have to do it.
A telegram or do I need
I need
an editable arrangement.
I'll put my mailing address in the chat so you can send it to me. No pressure. I really want to stress.
I will tell you this. I was excited to see your name because I know we've had nice conversations in the past.
No, and I appreciate that. And I'm trying to be honest about it because you're dealing with a thing. Like you say, you put something out, there's going to be a reception. And you have to deal with that, but it's your thing and you're going to live with it beyond that press cycle. You're going to, unless you feel it's a failure, you're going to keep going. And that's how some of us in this realm are working right now. Every week I make a thing to get better and better and better. Sorry, this is not to be about me. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, Jeff, but I'm just saying.
No, I'm enjoying this.
Well, the process of exchange is what we're talking about a little bit. I make a thing or you make a thing. People consume it. It gives them feelings. That's great.
I'm really fascinated by this topic because it is something that you do because you want to connect and you want to have this conversation. You want to have this acknowledgement of what you just said. Yeah. You know, this isn't a one-way conversation. I'd love to know what you think. And here, I mean, I'm just talking figuratively about getting some energy back from the universe in the form of different people's reactions. And to be completely honest, I'm amazed at how blindsided I am every single time I put a record out by the fact, not that everybody doesn't love it, but that people go out of their way to weigh in with certain types of reactions that aren't even considered.
Right.
You know, or that are just like, I haven't listened to it yet, but blah.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Or like, why can't it be this? And I'm like, I really think about it a lot. But I think about it. It's worth introspecting because it's kind of amazing that I have this resilience that can completely forget that that happens, that hurts my feelings a little bit or upsets me, just confuses me a tad. Yeah. It doesn't make me love what I do any less. It actually, that's the really uplifting part of it, is I feel even more strongly about what I'm doing when I start to get some of that reaction that's sort of ambivalent, you know?
Well, I think when you're in the zone of making things to foster human connection and people react where they don't even consider it, their reflex is to dehumanize it, to mm-hmm. treat it like it wasn't built by a human. I used to say this when I worked at the CBC, there would be like a general inbox for feedback. And if 10 things or if 9 things were nice, the one negative one would bother me so much so that I would, mm-hmm. I would correspond with that person more like I was more prone to be like, and it wasn't like defensive. I was just like, hey, sorry, you didn't like that thing. Appreciate the feedback. And I don't know what I was going for there in retrospect. I was a younger man. Maybe I was being passive aggressive, but I also think I was like, no, honestly, your opinion was heard. I'm a human mm-hmm. being that you're mm-hmm. lashing out at to a general inbox. I'm telling you 100% of the time, oh, I'm so sorry. I didn't realize someone was going to read this. I didn't realize you were going to read this. I'm just lashing out because I thought that this mechanism of dehumanized communication wasn't actually going to hit a human. So I don't know if you can relate to that.
Oh, 100%. I totally get the impulse to respond to the negative reactions that you get. I also have a desire not to reward only. Yeah. I mean, this happens on my Substack. I write on a Substack and that's one place where I feel really compelled to stay in touch with what people are writing and read the comments and stuff. And it is, I have to stop myself from only responding to the people that are actually acting out kind of needing some attention, whether it's negative or positive. And I think that's a human impulse, you know, to like, oh, well, I need to set you straight. And I think you're right. I think a lot of times they have completely forgotten or have never had any idea what it takes to make something and put it out into the world, and therefore cannot even fathom that there are feelings and attack, you know, and there's an emotional investment on the other end of this bargain.
Yeah. Yeah. I alluded to the fact that I did that sort of stuff more when I was younger, and I was also not a parent. And now I'm a parent and I have mm-hmm. two young children, and sometimes there are emotions. I don't know if I'm sure you're familiar mm-hmm. with this.
Yeah.
And so negotiating that and figuring out where the anger is coming from and realizing like, oh, they're angry at themselves. And that probably means that whenever I'm angry, I'm a little angry at myself. And so I mm-hmm. I really have firmly started to come to terms with when someone lashes out at you or me and it's mm-hmm. anonymous, something not happy there. There's like no joy. There's something like not, there's not a happiness there that they felt compelled.
Oh, no.
What do you think?
I think that's pretty clear.
Yeah.
Pretty clearly the case.
Yeah.
And just out of curiosity, it's like if you say, for example, see something written about you on Twitter and it's almost invariably somebody that has very limited engagement with the world. Like if you mm-hmm. just like do a little bit of like, who's saying this to me? I want to know who's saying this to me because it's interesting.
Yeah.
And it's not just like my ego is bruised. I just want to understand it because I'm on this end of it and I have a certain amount of understanding about what I've put into it. But who is this person? And you ultimately feel real sadness, you know, yeah. because they'll have like 10 followers or they'll have like this, like, you know, obvious desire to make this connection. And they're just bad at it. They're just really bad at social interactions. And it seems like they're probably bad at it in their lives outside of social media. That's a good reason never to engage, because it's only kind of punching down in this, and there's this iniquity in how my platform is going to be perceived as being, I don't know, like a bully. It's like a bully at pulpit or something. You
yeah.
know?
Yeah, absolutely. I do think I've been more relaxed about, again, I don't receive as much feedback about what I do as you do, because that's the whole game, really, is you put out a record or you play a show and someone's going to talk about it. And they're going to highlight mm-hmm. what they're going to highlight, and they're going to be confused about what they're going to be confused about. I'm just, by the way, foreshadowing mm-hmm. the rest of this conversation, potentially, as I talk to mm-hmm. you about lyrics and my interpretations about them, perhaps. But anyway, yeah, people are different, and they are coming to everything mm-hmm. with their own perspective, but also mm-hmm. pain. And so, mm-hmm. you know, I look back at some old reviews of something I might have written and realize if they were negative in some way, I'm like, well, what was going on with my life that day? What was happening mm-hmm. with me? Was I upset about something? Oh, that was right around when so, mm-hmm. such and such was going on. So I'm trying to really contextualize these comments mm-hmm. and these actions. But I'm also trying to move the one thing I'll say, because you've been on a really prolific clip, but it's still spaced out. Like, you'll put out a record. I mean, like I say, I'm just glancing over at where your solo records are in the T section here. And you just seem to be putting out records a lot in the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. And I'm only relating that to what someone like me does, because I put myself on a hamster wheel myself, done this to myself mm-hmm. once a week, twice a week. I'm just going to keep doing this and making stuff and learning from it, but it creates an immunity. It creates a little bit mm-hmm. of, like, sometimes it's going to go well, sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's going to be received mm-hmm. well, and sometimes it's not. And I just have to keep on to the next one. So do you have mm-hmm. that at this point in your trajectory, having made so many records for so long? I get that it gets to you, whatever you're getting back, but are you able to be like... Mm-hmm. Like, compartmentalize it and just keep, you must, I think the answer is obvious because you're still here. We're still talking about new records, mm-hmm. but clearly you think about this. Are you at a point where you can just like, okay, I guess that's what happened and on with it. I'm going to keep going.
Yeah. No, he was going to say something that was so hurtful that it would make me stop doing what I do. It would have happened a long, long time ago, but no, I don't mean to make it sound like I'm sitting around reading my reviews and sorry for myself, because that's not happening. And one of the reasons it doesn't happen is because the antidote is, and always has been, that by the time something is put out into the world, I'm already writing new songs. I'm already thinking about the next record, and I'm excited about how the world is going to unfold into this new thing that I feel like I'm getting better at. And I see progress in myself over a long period of time. I feel like just the record I just made, I feel like certain things I just could not have done 10 years ago or 5 years ago. And even things that nobody would ever be able to hear, but just how much easier it was for me to play a certain chord progression in the rhythm I wanted it to be, and how it felt to me to be not having to think about it so hard or something. You know, there's very subtle things that it's just like, notice this incremental growth, and that's very rewarding, and it is sustaining, yeah. You know, and I have a couple real quick things to say about what we were just talking about, though. It doesn't just happen in social media. And I've noticed this on stage as well. And I think it's an evolutionary thing that we are on the lookout for danger. And on stage, when you look out at an audience, you automatically see the person yawning. The entire audience could be smiling, having a good time, having a great time. And you notice all of the people having a bad time without even looking for them. And it took me a long time to realize that I was doing that and not obsessing about them, but definitely giving them more of my energy than they deserved, because they would be sitting next to somebody that's having the time of their life, and you want to sing to them. You want to sing to the people that are giving it back to you. But I feel like it's something that's like sort of primal.
Well, no, it's
about.
Yeah, I've read books about this, and apparently I didn't know this, but it makes sense for me. We have a very negative bias. Our brains have this negative bias. And I didn't know that. I just thought maybe I mm-hmm. was a bit grumpy. But your brain does, your brain tends to have, I don't know, the example I cited about scanning a feedback inbox and gravitating towards a negative one, or what you're describing, it is evolutionary. For whatever reason, people yeah. like us, at least you and me at this point, we are drawn to the negative energy to try. I think it's because we want to, I think there's part of us that wishes we could fix it for that person.
Right.
And right. I don't know what that's about. I don't think it's all narcissism. I don't think it's all, there's something there. I hope it's more than that, those things. I think it's just.
It's a challenge.
Yes, it's a challenge.
That person, and it's also a certain amount of protecting. If something bad is going to happen, it's going to come from that guy. Or like if the show's going to be a failure, it's going to grow out of this energy right here. So I need to into this energy and extinguish it or at least disarm it somehow. And I feel like that's possible. That my brain is doing that calculus.
That's fascinating. That's probably what it is. You've actually hit the nail on the head. You go to the negative. If I think back to 12, 15 years ago, whenever I was doing that thing where I was looking in the inbox, probably didn't want that person's opinion to spread. You know what I mean? I never thought of that way. Huh? Mm-hmm. All right. Well, this has been a good session. Thank you very much, Jeff. You've
the thing I was saying that I've realized over the years is that, you know, I look at making art and putting it out in the world as an act of love. I think it's a loving thing to do. I mean, that sounds very exalted and whatever, but I think it is. An effort to connect, which grows out of a sincere desire to share my affection for the world. And it is an act of love, in my opinion. And some people are upset to the point where they're not going to welcome every act of love. If you're in a relationship, there are times where you get in arguments and you have to wait for the right time to say you're sorry. Even someone's not even going to willingly accept that gesture right away. Yeah. I think there are a lot of people out there really hurt and really feel betrayed by the world. And they can even project that feeling of betrayal on a band that they've loved and has changed and hasn't stayed the same and hasn't been, or is a reflection of them getting older. There are a lot of ways that this relationship that is developed with different people that listen to our music can feel like a betrayal. And I have to understand that and understand that they come at it not ready to accept me saying, I love you.
It's an absolutely excellent way of putting it. I think that's true. And I do think I think you know this, Jeff, like, I've followed your work for a long, long time. And I was thinking about it today that an older friend of mine worked at a record store when Being There came out. And I'd seen the videos on Much Music. I was in university at the time, so I lost my TV cable privileges when I moved out of my parents' house. But I'd seen the videos. Anyway, he handed me Being There. I paid for it. I didn't walk off with it. I paid for it. And ever since, just totally immersed. And you talk about people's reaction to the band changing. And I was thinking about it today, like the change in Wilco for me has been so imperceptible. I've seen the band so many times. I've immersed myself in all your records. And the closest analogy I could come up with is when someone who knows my family sees my kids for the first time in a while, they'll be like, oh, they got so big. And I think, oh, I didn't even notice. I see them every day. So I'm saying, as a fan, I feel like I just have seen Wilco every day. So I haven't, I will say, if I'm going through the discography, I'm like, oh yeah, this was a bit of a left turn. But what I'm saying is your change, your evolution isn't with me every day. I've just accepted it that I'm on this ride with you. You're one of my favorite bands. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to go where I'm going to trust you too. You're the pilots. I'm trusting you. Mm-hmm. I feel this way about certain bands where I was just along for the whole ride or I am still, and that's it. That's where I'm at with it. I have trouble picking favorite records. I have trouble. I'm like, I'm on the ride right now. I'll tell you maybe at the end how it worked out. Anyway, I just wanted to put that to you in terms of one fan letting you know how I perceive your changes, if you will. I'm putting that in air quotes for those listening.
Thank you. Well, I think that that's, I feel like we have a lot of connections with people that are similar to your experience. And that makes me really, really happy. That's like a really human scale bit of information to have. It feels rewarding to know that, I mean, that's sort of the spirit that everything's made in, you know, like, hey, I'm going to be honest about who I am right now. And I'm going to put this up. This is the best I can do right now. I promise you, this is the best I can do. I'm not trying to point over on you. I'm not trying to make something that I just want your cash. You know, but then there are people that are much more casual than that about almost any artist. And there are a lot of people that have a specific moment in their life where they really form an identity around a few pieces of music or a few bands or a few things that I'm that guy. I'm a replacements guy, or, you know, like they have this guy. Oh, yeah. That fits me. And it's, you know, it has the same danger that almost any kind of external identity appropriation is going to have, is that there's a shelf life for it. And it's not the same as following an artistic output. It's more, it's been absorbed into some other need that isn't necessarily artistic.
Do you relate to that? Because I think there are people who will go to a show, let's say by Wilco, and they'll leave the show and someone will say, how was the show? And they say, it was good, but they only played two songs from Yankee Hotel Foxtrot. I didn't like that. And if you step back and, well, how was the rest of the show? It was good, but that's my record. We're talking about projection earlier, I think, a little bit. And I do think that people, the records that mean the most to them remind them of a time where they felt the best. And does that make sense? Like, I do. I've been to a couple of shows. I know you've engaged with them too. The shows where you play a record front to back, and I know that that's got to be inherently thrilling and maybe a little like, am I just a nostalgia machine right now for these people? But you are like, you are, by doing that, transforming the space into a year, probably a year in time for you and for the fans who are like. You've done this, I think, haven't you, in Chicago, where you'll be like, this night we're playing AM, this night we're playing Being There. Have you guys done that? I think you have, right? Like, you've played records over successive nights, like, sequentially?
We only did that at Solid Sound one time, where we had the audience vote ahead of time on the record they wanted us to do that to. And they voted, they're not dummies, so they voted on the longest record. They voted for Being There. And then, just on a whim, we actually went out and encored with Yankee Hotel Foxtrot.
Right, right.
And up until that moment, that was the only time we'd ever played those albums in their entirety, sequenced the way they are on the record.
Right.
Maybe we did Yankee Hotel Foxtrot as like a promo thing right before it came out, where we played the whole thing. But no, it's been a very rare. That was at the time it came out.
Well, that would make sense. Yeah.
Yeah. And then recently we just did these anniversary shows, and these were really the first shows I think of as album shows. We really, really tried to recreate the album and the sequence and relearned all of the old arrangements and the subtle things that have changed over the years from playing all the songs and having them in all of them have remained in rotation in our repertoire. So we had to learn things from certain, just these odd measures would get like changed over time. Like sometimes, why is there like an extra bar here? We used to never play this. And so we had to like unlearn muscle memory and everything. And that was I was really shocked at how devastating it was for me emotionally to like play that whole record through and then, feel that audience wait. But it was beautiful. I was just really happy when we got that. We had eight shows that we did Yankee Hotel Foxtrot. And I was really happy that we didn't have 20, you know, I was really happy that we made it somewhat, we had not bitten off more than we could chew for that.
Yeah. So
but it was also the music like that is sequenced and pace to be a certain experience in and of itself, aside from the individual songs. It really is. And that spell being cast over 55 minutes is a different thing. And then by the end of the show, when we would get to the long, super long drawn out fade out coda of Reservations, the fact that the audience stayed quiet all the way through the end of it, and then the record would actually end before people knew it ended, and there would just be this air in the room still just kind of hanging there before people would start applauding, that just like would wipe me out every night. It made me cry so much. It's just such a powerful experience that doesn't happen if you just play the coda to Reservations.
Yeah. So it's emotionally transformative for you as much as it is the audience. And I can appreciate that, but it is an interesting, where I'm coming from is psychologically or whatever, behaviorally, that's an interesting knot. Because someone like me is going to remember when I went on the Yankee Hotel Foxtrot tour. Oh, yeah, that's when I met my now wife. Like, it's just like a weird time machine thing for each person is going to bring right. Their own joy and pain from whenever that they experience that record and what that record. Because records mean they're little markers in time for some of us, right? Like, oh, yeah, when I first heard this, even just telling you about.
But it's not all the same time.
Exactly.
I mean, there were teenage kids there that had just gotten into the record. Yeah. These shows, and there's still a weight to it when a record becomes something like a companion to someone. Yeah. You know, it has a role in keeping someone company. You know,
yeah, no, absolutely. I find this conversation fascinating because I've long thought that you have a particular interest in sort of human behavior in your songwriting mm-hmm. and in the books you've written as well, and. This brings me in a weird way to some of the lyrics on this record. If you don't mind, I'd like to read a couple of them out to you. This
sure.
could be awkward, but I don't know. So I want to begin by reading the lyrics to Hearts Hard to Find. I don't mind when certain people die. I can't cry. I wonder why. I could lie and say it makes me sad. There's something wrong with me. Maybe I'm just bad. My heart's hard to find. Sometimes, oh, I lose it all the time. So very, very fascinating on several levels. I have thoughts about these, but I actually want it. Well, also, I think, and this is just me fanboying out, I feel like there's a little trilogy happening between that song, The Universe, and Many Worlds. That's where I'm reading it. I think that song's at the end of that, right? I think that's mm-hmm. right. Yeah, anyway, before we get into me... Do you have a sense of where the line like, I don't mind when certain people die came from? Because we've been talking a lot about how humans are relating to one another. And this has been the pandemic has been a very strange mm-hmm. time for the kind of dehumanization. I was talking about, I think, more benign versions of it. But I hear mm-hmm. that a lot on this particular record. That particular sequence of words, can you talk a little bit about where that might have come from?
I mean... It could have come from a lot of different places in my experience and interactions with the world and just just experiencing the world through media. Mm. We live in a time where celebrity culture is coming to an age where a lot of people that we grew up with are dying, and we're aware of more people probably than any other generation, or at least the people alive now are aware of more people, know the names of, and have some awareness of more people probably than any other group of humans that walk the earth. And because the prevalence of media, prevalence of television, prevalence of, you know, our culture is just, I don't know, I just can't imagine someone 100 years ago knew about or would be aware of the multitudes of deaths of happening every day of minor celebrities or just notable people that we just watch come and go all day long.
That's a whole other way of looking. I didn't even consider that. That makes sense. I was looking at it from a different point of view, but that's fascinating.
Well, but I don't think it's necessarily from that, but it's just like something I've thought about. And it's some celebrity deaths really, really hits you. And then there's some that you even if you loved the person, you cared about the person, you enjoyed their work, just like, oh, you know, I don't like when John Prine died, it really, really hit me. It really hurt. It really just didn't feel like I could cope with that knowledge. Yeah. And as much as I love Prince, I can't say that that same feeling happened to me. It's a weird sensation. I didn't have that sense of like almost familial loss or like, you know, it was just, he wasn't, if I'm being completely honest, he wasn't completely real to me. He was just Prince is Prince to me, the way he was when he was alive.
Right. Right. He didn't seem real. Yeah.
Well, the way his persona, everything about him to me feels very similar to when he was alive. I didn't lose very much of that connection.
I can't recall. Did you interact much, a fair amount rather, with John Prine personally?
Nope. I met him a few times, but no, I didn't have a deep, you know, interaction with him.
So you're
but that being said, necessarily the people I'm singing about in that song, sure. You know, I could be singing about my cousin calling me up and telling me that my aunt died or something like that. And I think I'm just trying to be honest, you know,
yeah.
It's not necessarily saying I don't care about somebody dying. It's just trying to be honest about the fact that even somebody you love, when they die, you don't always get to have the emotion you want to have at that moment. I felt like I wasn't crying enough and upset enough when my dad died. You know, that's just completely honest. And ultimately it hit me really, really hard. And I grieved. I still grieve my father being gone. I grieve my mother being gone. But I think most people can relate to that, but they don't want to talk about the fact that is one of the surreal things that happens when we experience loss is that it doesn't hit you in the way you feel like is proper or you're supposed to grieve. And that's a learning process that as you get older, you learn that you can't force when it hits you. You can't expect yourself to be able to appreciate the loss for what it is in the moment. It's not on demand.
That is a really, I appreciate that perspective on it because I couldn't help but read it in terms of the way I feel like at this point in time, we have been really inundated with death on a
for
mass
sure.
scale, obviously because of this pandemic. And I think it's created both a bit of numbness, but within that resignation, like this is just happening. And, you know, I've lost some people to COVID, but it's gone from like, this is really sad to, I guess that's just what's going to happen, and then some people say, well, that's you yourself have said we were born to die. Like there's just this is going to happen. It might be happening sooner, but then it's creating this polarization. About how seriously are we to take it? And at the extreme end of interpreting that lyric, we've seen some real like Schadenfreude. Oh, of course that person died. They were against vaccines. They were against, you know, like I've seen that too. So it's just a level of dehumanization. I hate to keep using that term. I'm not familiar with this level of it, this level of acceptance that something that seems preventable in terms of causing the casualties as it is sort of being has been politicized, but also like, I don't know, people are just like, I give up. I'm not going to try to protect people. I don't care about other people. I'm not going to wear masks. I'm not going to do this and that. So there's where I was coming from. And that just
when you heard that what you thought it was about?
It struck me again. This is what I'm bringing to it, right? Because I think it struck a nerve with me. Obviously, it struck a nerve with me. I've pointed it out. I don't like to say I don't mind when certain people die. It's a pretty cool thing to say. But I also think it's kind of what's happening socially, politically right now. It's not even a harsh thing. It's just like, I don't know what it's like. You're saying I can't be sad all the time for all of these deaths that I'm confronted with every day. Because we are. I think it's safe to say we are. It's not just celebrities. It's like human beings. If you go on Twitter, there's like memorials to COVID victims. Like there's just threads.
Right.
And, you know, and obviously as we're speaking in the wake of America and its constant mass shootings, like it, you get a little numb. I can tell you, like, it hurts like hell, and I have children, and but you get a little like, yeah, I guess that's just the way that is. So that's where I'm coming from. It's like there's a resigned acceptance in that kind of sentiment, but I can't tell if you were coming at it. I appreciate you're like, I'm just being honest, but I couldn't tell if it was critical as well of that sentiment. Does that make sense?
Right. I don't really know. I don't. I mean, I'm questioning whether am I just a bad person? I don't think I am. But I also don't think that being good is defined by being able to be sad at every single loss of life or being aware. I mean, like literally,
yeah,
it would never end. It would never end. And especially living in a time like the time we've been living through, I don't know what other option you have other than to inoculate yourself from a certain amount of, you know, just you're going to be aware of it. But do you have to invest in every death as an emotional event for you personally, even for people you don't know and things? I mean, we're not good at death as a culture. As Americans, I'm a convert to Judaism. I appreciate a lot about the way in the Jewish tradition death is treated, and like the some of the rules around grieving really make a lot of sense. Not necessarily rules, but sort of just like the wisdom around, well, give it a year, you know, and come back and dedicate the stone, or, you know, like let's bury the person as soon as possible. Like the open casket thing of my childhood is a strange, you know, tradition.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I think we prefer not to think about it. We're just very, very, and I think because of that, we prefer not to think about it. We've gotten really good at not thinking about it. And then this time period happens where I think even during the Spanish flu, same as something similar in terms of a pandemic, you know, you probably see newspaper reports, but there's no way that you have the same at your fingertips kind of access to the world suffering at every moment and that with that media structure at that time. It's a very complicating element to throw into the mix of a pandemic. Obviously it killed a lot of people. It had to have killed a lot of people. The fact that the way we communicate involves this sort of wild west of information and interaction. There's no doubt that people got their information from the wrong place, ended up doing something that they would have otherwise maybe avoided and died.
Well, I hear you trying to articulate communication breakdowns, language barriers throughout this record even. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean that as a straight English language versus other language. Like there's the line in The Universe, talk to me, I don't want to hear poetry, say it plain, like how you really speak. And that's just mind-blowing right now in an age where people distrust information and also choose which information they're going to get and peddle disinformation. Like I know there's I was looking at that and I was like, is that about anti-intellectualism? Is it how people do or don't value art? What's going on in that, you know? And again, I hate to put you on the spot each time with like, tell me what it means. But are you employing let me put it to you this way. Are you employing the voice of someone who's talking to someone like you who does what you do? when you invoke poetry, it's, you know, it's like, I don't understand your abstraction. Clear it up for me. I feel like this sentiment is throughout this record. It feels to me like a record really about interpersonal connection and communication. But that stuck out to me as like, oh, yeah, we're not all speaking the same language. We don't understand each other. So what are we saying? How are we communicating? Sorry. What do you make of where I'm coming from with that in terms of that song?
Well, I mean, again, I don't know if I'm singing to someone or to myself. in a lot of cases, you know. Mm-hmm. It's very muddled, and in a situation like this, I think I could hold both points of view pretty with equal conviction. You know, I think that I definitely feel an impulse to not write the way I've written a lot in my life right now. I feel like the abstractions cannot possibly stand out in contrast to the abstractions of the world that we're maneuvering through right now. There's, you know, it's like surrealism feels very quaint to me at this moment in history, you know, like a surrealistic game to get language to jump off the page. I'm sorry, I don't have a lot of patience for that type of art right now. So I think it does grow out of a certain amount of, listen, Jeff, don't do this. You don't need to do this. I mean, what do you, I mean, actually, that's a thread throughout everything I've ever written, even the abstractions, even the things that I was just trying to find some way to say something I feel is very, very simple and elemental. And I don't know how to get it to be clear or understood. And in the past, a certain amount of experimentation or abstraction of language is a reaction to language being very, very inefficient. And, you know, like Gertrude Stein, if a rose is a rose is a rose, okay, now I finally fucking see the rose. you know, like it couldn't, you don't just don't write there's a rose on the page. At some point, language has emptied itself of its original meanings. It's become impotent to express something that it was designed to express. And you have to do something different to shake people out of their assumption that you're saying what you're saying.
Right.
And at this moment in time, those strategies for communicating felt very frivolous and unappealing to me. And so there was a constant feeling, and that's why I think country songs and country forms and folk song forms felt very useful to try and pour something into them that felt very unsettled, but needed a foundation, needed something solid enough to build on.
I was thinking about this today because I'm a country music fan and I have a sense memory of when I first sort of encountered it. But as I grew older, I realized it was more complicated than I thought it was. And I also, the more I studied it, the more I realized how connected to jazz it was in terms of guitar playing in particular. Do you think it's misconstrued as a very simple art form, country music?
I think, I think that, I'm just trying to find a place to sit.
That looks complicated.
That was complicated. I'm not going to be able to get up now.
Do I need to call someone?
Vish, I live here on the floor now of this cabin, and you might need to call my wife. Yeah.
Okay. I'll call Suze. We'll get something worked out here. Yeah.
I mean, it's such a broad thing. I don't know. I mean, some of it is very simple and some of it is incredibly complex. And the trick is for you to not know which is which, you know?
I think there's a perception or there's lore, or I don't know what to call it, but the narrative around your band is that Wilco were associated with alt country and folk country or whatever, folk rock. And like I was saying earlier, to me, those changes are almost imperceptible to me now. I don't even remember what everyone was going on about, but there is this feeling that you made a conscious decision to leave that world a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then in your essay that accompanies this record, you talk about, actually, you know what? We've gone country, like kind of a self-aware acknowledgement of how the band is perceived in relation to that genre. Mm-hmm. So I guess what I'm getting at is, what was it about that? We hear this all the time. Folk musicians, some of them very famously, go electric.
Right.
there's something about the form that feels like people want to transcend it. if you look back on it now in the context of this record, which again, it's called Cruel Country. To me, it sounds like country music. But when you think back on where you were and getting, again, I don't want to suggest you were getting away from it unless you agree with that sentiment, because I feel like it's reductive. But when you think back about what you were supposedly getting away from, what was it? Was there some orthodoxy there that you were feeling cramped by? Or what was it? What was going on that made you think we got to get away from whatever this genre signifier is or we're fucked?
I think, well, aside from just being a little uncomfortable with any genre as a place to reside and work within, I think at the time there was a toxic concern with authenticity at the time that I wanted no part of at all, because I feel like it's completely dishonest and completely counterproductive to the act of making art that is honest. Because to me, you don't get to choose whether you're authentic or not based on your style or your clothes or your record collection or anything like that. And all the people that made the body of work, the songbook that I'm most comfortable with or familiar with, they did not do it with any consideration of themselves being authentic, in my opinion. You know, in fact, some of them were completely inauthentic intentionally. Right. There's like, you know, Jewish songwriting teams in New York writing country songs or like writing, you know, songs for rural artists to sing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Also, they're just people sitting on their porches playing whatever they could get their hands on. And you know, the fact that they could only get a cheap, crappy banjo would dictate a certain amount of virtuosity. Could be achieved on that. Hmm. But that wasn't the essence of it. The essence of it was to make a noise and liberate yourself to express yourself in your community, at the dance, at the, you know, whatever. It was functional. There was a functionality to it. It wasn't beholden to a marketing term, which is exactly what it is. That music was made by the same people for a long period of time. There was black people, white people, everybody doing what they could have been called anything. And it was divided up at a certain point in time when the recording industry decided that was a way to sell records and make sure that you found the right audience for them, and also to make sure that they didn't mix. They right. did not find each other. And that's all pretty wrong, in my opinion.
Well, and I think internet consumption has destroyed all that orthodoxy, right? There's no, for better or for worse, mm-hmm. there's not a lot of puritanical music genre people anymore, particularly younger.
It's extremely quaint. My kids just can't even fathom what it was like to have lines in the sand drawn around whether you liked the Ramones or, you know, Hall and Oates or something like that. Yeah. At a certain period in his history, they like everything, anything. There's no embarrassment about liking something. It's the way it should be. And on top of that all, the internet has made all things happening all at once. So there aren't these wild jumps culturally between, you know, when we made our first record in 1990 with Uncle Tupelo, we were only 20 years away from 1970. You could say we were 30 years away from 1960. If you look at the difference in music in 1960 and when we made our first record, it's wild.
Yeah.
You know, and now we're 30 years from our first record, 32 years.
Yeah.
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 That just doesn't look that wildly different to me.
No, there's
does it to anyone?
No, I feel like time's become a bit of a flat circle. Because if you look at how we dress, like you could, yeah. I remember seeing photos of people in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. That's when I was born in the late 70s. And each photo, like the medium changed, like the The photos looked different from one. The 70s photos looked a lot different from the 80s. The technology changed. Doesn't it? This is very reductive, but by and large, yes, there's been some high definition changes. Like there's some stuff that has changed on a technical level, but we kind of, I feel like we all dress however we want. There's no like 90s aesthetic like there was with hair or whatever you want to call it. Everyone just, everyone's just sort of given up on.
When I go on this rant with my kids, they actually disagree. They think that they can absolutely tell the difference between a song that came out in 2005 and a song that came out in 2015 or something like that. And I think with certain, maybe more pop, certain genres, if we're looking at very specific things, you could probably make a case that there are real differences in production and things like that. But my point to them, I don't think they can even understand it. I don't think they can even grasp, because it's all happening at once and has been since they were born. They don't get how weird it is that that Happy Days was on when we were kids in the 70s. It's like glorifying something that only happened 13 years earlier at a nostalgia trip.
So quickly. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it is weird. I appreciate what you're saying about genre signifiers. The record, though, is called Cruel Country. And based on your essay and just listening to it, I feel like there's two meanings there. You're alluding to country music, but you're alluding to the country of the United States of America is where I'm coming from. Does country music feel to you like a particularly American art form? Like maybe more than... I know this is very complicated, and someone will call us out. Call me out for even intimating this, given the way traditions work and how they travel. But in its current form or current understanding of the form, does it feel particularly American to you?
Well, I mean,
stumped you.
I mean, I think there are certain things that I think of when I think of country music and American folk music that feels that way to me, because I can't picture it being made anywhere else. There is an element of the land and location and regionality and vocabularies and vernaculars and you know, there is an indigenous nature to some of it, you know. That being said, I think that the term itself is an agreed upon fiction, you know, just like the United States is an agreed upon fiction. I take a great deal of pride in like thinking that I'm part of something that's a tradition. But it's not just a tradition of American artists. It's a tradition of humans in my like feeling compelled to make noise and be heard and liberate themselves again into some state of mind where they can feel comfortable being themselves on purpose, you know? And then what happens that grows from that is somebody else sees somebody do that as a model behavior, and it becomes a movement, and maybe a little microscopic movement. And it's happened over and over and over again. Punk rock was that, and hardcore punk rock in Southern California was that. Hillbilly music in Appalachia was that to some degree. No, I mean, it's just that somebody sees somebody do it.
Yeah. And I appreciate how things get codified. Like that part I get, but I think, correct me if I'm wrong, like, you have employed this phrase for two reasons. Is that fair to say? I feel like I'm deriving this from your own words, but do you feel like it is a reflection of country music as you interpret it and convey it as a band, but also it is clearly a look at America from your vantage point. Is that fair?
Yeah. I mean, I think I can say all of this honestly while still being a little bit suspicious of the term, in that I want to communicate where I feel like people are. It's a part of the communication. It's a part of the effort to communicate. If I say it's country, but it doesn't sound like country to somebody, that's fine. But I think that there's an act of sincerity in saying, but it is country. This is my country. This is my country too. This is what I'm allowed to love this too. I'm allowed to love this thing that you have taken ownership of, whoever you is, or have decided it can only be one thing. There's a little bit of an act of defiance, in my opinion, and just saying, okay, well, let's call this one country. This is what this is. And let's see how that changes how you think about what it is. Because in my opinion, probably more prominently in the way I've worked my whole life, it's all the same. It's all the exact same thing.
That's kind of where I was coming from before. And I didn't mean, I know there will be fans who disagree. I view it as like the same thing. This record, when I think about all the records, it feels the same. However, you're a music fan, Jeff. I know this as well. Music fans can get obsessed with artistic eras, phases, like just curious. I remember watching that show you do with your family once. What's it called? It's on Instagram. I'm forgetting.
The Tweety Show, Stuff in Our House.
It's a very simple name. Stuff in Our House. That's the thing I couldn't remember. I apologize. But you and your kids were going on a little riff about Bob Dylan's voice, Nashville Skyline era. And I was always stuck with me because I get really obsessed with different Bob Dylan eras and Wilco eras and Fugazi eras. Like there's eras, you know, we just can't help it. Can't help ourselves. And then what happens, I think, is you look for threads between the new work and their older stuff. I think you framed this record as being the first one you've made kind of like the way you made Sky Blue Sky. Is that accurate?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Live off the floor. So then, of course, I read that and then I'm listening. I'm like, oh yeah, that kind of sounds like it could be on Sky Blue Sky. And then it's a double record. So I'm like, oh, like being there. So my head just goes to those places and then I hear it. There's certain songs where I'm like, I can actually hear the entire Wilco discography on this double record because it's been a journey and that makes sense. Everything they've seen and experienced along the journey is going to be on the latest thing. Do you do that as a music fan? Do you compartmentalize an artist you love and get really obsessed with like the threads and how the new thing relates to maybe the old thing? And oh, what does that make me feel like? Does it give you like a visceral reaction when you hear and feel those things?
I mean, I think as a music fan, I've tried to put together an accurate timeline just so I can understand an artist's evolution that I care about. You know, like I think it's harder to contemplate if I don't know that, say, for example, where Desire falls in Dylan's catalog. It wouldn't be confusing to me, I think, to try and figure out how that happened, if it was earlier, or how it happened, if it was later, you know, you have, like, I have to have some context. And the artists I really care about, I mean, I think that thread makes sense to pay attention to, or an author, you know, just like following the way that their work evolves and deepens, or maybe loses you a certain amount some of the time. It's all fairly interesting if you're already interested in the artist, if you have a if you have a deep kind of like ride or die connection to the person, the author, the artist. It's important to pay attention to it. I think the thing that you're asking about is whether or not it means any more than it means for me to take advantage of the fact that Wilco doesn't exist in a vacuum. Yeah. Wilco is aware of the things that have been said about Wilco. We are aware and connected to our fans. We are aware of the fact that if I say this is a country record, that is going to change a certain amount about the way people come to it and what they listen to. And the question is, am I supposed to not do that? The question is, am I supposed to not put things out with all of the tools available to lead people to kind of receive it in the way that I hope that they do? And I think it's completely within my role to be a Sherpa of some sort to get people to come to the music in a way that contributes to the most, to get them, I don't know, come to them where they are, understanding where they are, and then hopefully still able to use that as something that's very hard to do after many, many years of making records. And that is to create some sense of awe or surprise, some sense of like discovery for something after 12 records is, I mean, I've experienced many, many times where I feel like if Schmilko had come out and it was the only record that ever had been put out by Wilco, I believe in those songs and the weirdness of that record and the uniqueness of that record so much that I think that a perception of it would have been much different if it was by a band that nobody had ever heard of.
Huh. Right. So it's the context. Okay. I appreciate that.
It's a context that I don't have much control over, but in this case, I used a tiny amount of like what little control I have to just, I don't know, just to set it up and set up like with the, that's what a title does. I just, the essay that came with it is just an extension of the title. If it was the title alone, I think would have probably accomplished what I'm talking about. Mm. It's just like having the word country in the title and the cover art is what everybody does. That's a part of presenting your art to the world. Mm. And hopefully functions that way to say, come here.
Okay. So in terms listen. Yeah. And I appreciate that. So in terms of what you've conveyed, you are pointing a little bit to the band's past, whether it's Sky Blue Sky, whether the fact that you're talking about how the earliest perception of the band was that it was a country band. You've written two books recently mm-hmm. too. One was a memoir. One was I'm like David Letterman. I have a copy of the latest one right here for those of you at home who can't actually see this because it's an audio experience. How to Write One Song is the book I was holding up. So you've written some books. You're talking about older things that have happened in Wilco's trajectory that may inform how you approached your brand new record. So I think we're right to assume you're feeling a little reflective these days. Is that true? Like, can you honestly say like, yeah, I actually, if I think about it, I am pondering life a little, the past a little bit. I mean, a lot of us have been doing this during the pandemic, I'll tell you, Jeff, just for comfort. Because pre 2019 yeah. we realized probably some of us, that was actually pretty good. I mean, as much as it sucked for a lot of us, a lot of people, it wasn't as bad as what the subsequent couple of years were. So people were telling me in this context, oh, I used the downtime to dig into my history and find old records I haven't put out or whatever. Anyway, do you have any of that reflection coming through in the latest, your books or the latest record or anything like that?
Well, I mean, I have a real strong distrust and sort of distaste for nostalgia. So it makes me feel like I don't want to be misconstrued in admitting to any kind of reflection like that. If anything, there's a reality of this record is that it was being made at exactly the same time we were rehearsing for Yankee Hotel Foxtrot shows. Oh, yeah. You know, we were rehearsing for those shows in between takes for making this record. So we were playing Yankee Hotel Foxtrot as close to that record as we could in the studio and then recording Cruel Country. So there's a certain amount of nostalgia that's baked into that atmosphere when you're, you know, listening. We actually would pull up the record and listen to it and which synthesizer is that? Like let's dig it out. So actually some of the sounds on this record are sounds from Yankee Hotel Foxtrot. Hmm. Like there's organ, there's a synthesizer patch that I made for Yankee Hotel Foxtrot that sounds like an organ that's sort of catching fire. that's all over this record. And it's because we had dug out that keyboard and we're started like, you know, starting to prepare for these shows in New York and Chicago. But I'm only interested in nostalgia in the sense that you can get somebody to come to you, to listen to it in a nostalgic way, and then maybe hopefully subvert that and get them to understand that the past keeps changing too. The past isn't going to stay static any more than the future is. And there's still things to learn about the past, and there's still things to understand better about the past. And it's almost as inexhaustible as the future.
It's interesting to hear you talk about the relationship between Cruel Country and those Yankee Hotel Foxtrot things, because, and I appreciate what you were just saying about the past and the future, but there's a part in on the new record, I believe it's on Falling Apart Right Now. It's a chorus, because I'm going to be the only one falling apart right now. And your delivery reminded me a lot of I'm the Man Who Loves You. Like that same sort of like, I'm the only me. Like yeah. the narrative voice you're employing is like so adamant, if you will. And I was like, oh, that's like the same spirit. So sorry, I don't mean to conflate the two things based on what you just said.
No.
But do you see where I'm coming
from?
They're
both, like, both rooted in Doug Somm, probably somehow.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. Yeah. Now, there's something you said there that I wanted to get to. Oh, yeah, your songwriting. I mentioned this book. I mentioned How to Write One Song, and there's a particular song on the new record that I wanted to ask you about, because it's Bird Without a Tail, Base of My Skull, because every time it plays, I think of your book, because I think it's a really exhilaratingly unique lyrical approach for you or for anyone. As an exploration of songwriting, does that song stick out for you in any way, like in terms of what you usually do?
Well, it does, because there's a chapter in my books that advocates stealing, I think. And those lyrics are anonymously written from the 15th century.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. No, I took this anonymous poem that I thought that would be like important to have some reference to before there was a United States, before there was a country called the United States. There's another poem on the record that I repurposed a lot more than I didn't hardly rewrite any of the lyrics for Bird Without a Tail. And it's not called that. The poem is, I think the poem is called There Was a Man with Double Deed or something like that. I'm not sure what the actual title is, or if it even has a title.
Well,
but there's an Edgar Allan.
I didn't mean to cut you off, Jeff. I was just going to say, you were going to say something about Edgar Allan Poe. So all I wanted to say is it's the structure of it. It's not simply the wordplay. It's your choices you make as a singer, frankly, to just phrase this in a torrent with very, like, there's not like a verse, chorus, verse sort of structure to it, even though you accomplish that maybe with how you're singing. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
I think that that's what was interesting to me about this poem, is because I don't think it's a poem that was just came out of nowhere and somebody just made up this form. I think it was a form that other people used to remember things. There was a man with the double deed, sowed his garden full of seed. Then you say, when the seed began to grow, it was a garden full of snow. When the snow began to melt. So it becomes like this ladder to like, keep building on, and you could do it forever. And it's a really amazing mnemonic. Those lyrics are really easy to remember because they have this little kernel of the next line within the line preceding it.
Yeah.
That to me, I thought the music should reflect that. The music should never just turn back.
Yeah, it just goes.
They should just keep going as like it's building towards something. And in this case, it builds towards death.
It does do that. You've written a lot about death over the years, and it's impacted me philosophically on some levels, various levels. You have a lot of fun with death on this record in one particular song, A Lifetime to Find. Do you find yourself laughing at death more? I'm sorry I've made this so death heavy.
I'm sorry. It's my fault. I mean, if we weren't talking about my record, we'd probably be in a good mood.
No, it's a great record, but I do think, like I was trying to say, this is a bright spot. Like, I find that song sort of funny. Personally, has your opinion on death changed, Jeff? No, that's not what I meant to say. You're still against it? I believe you were against it.
No, I'm still, I don't like it. Nope, I'm not into it.
Has your perspective on death changed? Because it death is invoked a lot here. And we've talked about it already, like as an abstraction, like people die, people, I don't know who they are. I don't know if I'm supposed to care, but. What about you? Like, is your perspective?
What? I mean, that song, that song's from a tradition of songs too, that, you know, like, Oh Death, it's, you know, I think most famously people probably have been exposed to that song in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou. I have a version of it that I grew up listening to by Lloyd Chandler that was on a Rounder Records or Folkways record of songs from North Carolina Hills or something. And I said, really, always been really fascinating to me to that people. I mean, I feel really connected to people across centuries when you hear art that they made that reflects this fear of the unknown and this wrestling with an attempt to master their fear with art of something that scares them, you know, death in this case. But there are all kinds of songs like that are in that vein. And I think horror movies are kind of in that vein. It's a way to, you know, sort of master our fear in a safe place for things that are like the worst thing we can imagine. You know, like, well, let's go and like, let's go endure them and we'll be okay. And, but yeah, there's this conversation type song that has been written over and over and over again between when somebody as at the moment they're being called by death, their numbers come up.
Yeah.
And it's one of the first songs I wrote during the pandemic, you know, just thinking, oh, this is probably like the kind of thing that would be happening that would make somebody go sit in a cabin and write a song about death, or, you know, have a conversation with it and try and talk some sense into death or something, you know?
Yeah, it is a conversational song. And I believe one of the lines is like, oh, death, I can feel you in my chest, right? Which reminded me, made me think of the early days of the early days of coronavirus when we were really focused on that. It's going to take our breath away. So, yeah, it's you address death a lot. I've come to terms with the fact that the pandemic gave me pause to think, wait, isn't everything we do to stave off despair and the notion that we're going to die? Like almost everything. Right. We work, we do all these things. I think we know we're going to die. Again, I'm paraphrasing your own lyrics. I think I understand why it's fodder for songs and country music and other forms. It's just something we can all acknowledge is going to happen to us, right?
Yeah. I mean, everybody's, you know, it sounds really simplistic, but I don't know how much more there is to it other than everybody's just struggling to find a way to have more good days than bad days.
Yeah.
And we all kind of try and figure out different things that make us feel like we're having more good days than bad days. And it isn't easy, you know, but I'm very proud of one lyric in that song because it kind of sums up maybe part of the reason I'm obsessed with this topic. And I'm not the only one that's obsessed with it. And I'm certainly not the only artist that's made it somewhat of an obsession to introspect. But at the end of the song, Death says, oh, Jeff, don't obsess. It's the best that I can do to help you see the light and help the light to see you. It's true there was a truth. It was you and only you ever knew. You know, to me, I was like really, really felt moved that those words came to me and made sense of something that I had struggled to make sense of. And that is, I mean, I've known that the idea that we're going to not be here someday is a great motivation to do something.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, like if life was endless, I always, you know, it's like an impossible thought experiment to think of like, what would you even be bothered to do?
Right.
If there was no, nothing looming on the horizon that signaled that this wasn't going to last forever, what would motivate us? Mm. And I just think that lyric was a kinder way of saying that to myself, you know? And I also like the idea that we don't always choose to see the light. Sometimes the light sees us. And we don't like thinking of it that way. Mm-hmm. We don't like thinking that we don't have control over that. But there is a randomness to our good fortune. You know, there is a randomness to our situations that we find ourselves in, and we really, really have an almost impossible time contemplating randomness and not knowing.
Yeah, absolutely. I think things do. I was saying this to my wife today. Things kind of do work out for me. When I was fretting about something and then something shifted, I'm like, things kind of work out. And you really have to let go of controlling everything. And I have those issues. I know I have those issues.
Right.
And this has really crystallized that. I found it interesting that you were like, I was proud and pleased that these lyrics came to me. Again, I alluded to this book, How to Write One Song. This is among the first Wilco. Is this the first Wilco record to come out since you published this book? I feel like it is. Maybe.
Love is the King came out, but that was a solo. Yeah, the solo record came out.
Solo records are notwithstanding. I couldn't help it. I really thought of this book a lot more as I was poring over the lyric sheet and listening to how you, your word choices, frankly. Just out of curiosity, has anything about your approach to... Sorry. For those who don't know about the book, Jeff regales us with stories about writing exercises and ways of writing. As he mentioned earlier, stealing part of the book. No, it's really fascinating to just have you go through your process. Have you abandoned any of these practices or added new ones since the publication of this book? And if so, is any of that reflected on this new record?
I mean, I don't really, I mean, I don't tend to do the word ladders nearly as much as I used to. Maybe because I kind of did them as a practice for so long that I think my mind seems like it's always kind of storing up some of these odd associations. And I don't feel like I need to go looking for them as much through a process as it's like, I feel pretty good that the words are kind of coming to me. I like use those things in a, not necessarily for writer's block, but more when I'm feeling a little bit less inspired, I guess, you know, just like, it's a way to get inspired is to kind of like go through a process and start to see how your brain just can't help but make connections when you start putting words next to each other. And the book itself isn't really about learning how to write one song. It's more like taking my platform or my experience in the world and advocating for creativity just as a general rule. It's like, if I sum up that book in the simplest way, it would be just like, I just want people to have permission to make stuff.
No, absolutely. Yeah. I that's the spirit in which I took it. I think anyone from any field, it is a, I never think of you as a motivational speaker, although sometimes your banter is very motivational, if I may say, but it did have that spirit to it. Like, I'm sure it was, the seed was planted as people were like, how do you write a song? How do you do that? Right. And you're like, you know what? I'm just going to tell everyone at once and write this book. Does that probably some motivation there?
No, I think it was like, I mean, I've been unabashed about like the craft of songwriting my whole life. I don't have any problem with admitting that I've bought rhyming dictionaries. I've looked at other books on songwriting. I've tried to absorb the information that is out there to gather. And there's not very much good information from a philosophical standpoint about writing songs and creativity in general, in my opinion. The books on songwriting tend to be either one of two things. They tend to be either how to get your songs published, you know, like with are recorded by somebody. They're more about the business side of songwriting, or there are books about songwriting that kind of dwell a little bit more in the musical theory side of how to construct melodies or how to come up with chord progressions and things like that, which I don't spend a whole lot of time on at all in my book.
Yeah.
I wrote the book more as a desire to have had a book growing up that expanded my concept of what a song could be, that expanded my idea of what it is actually that I'm getting out of writing a song, what reward there actually is for it other than success or recording contract, or what reward there is. I mean, because I just think that has been way more beneficial to me in my life than anything that's happened to me career wise.
Yeah.
Is the good fortune of having found something that I love to do that takes me so far away from myself and so deep inside of myself simultaneously, yeah, to where like I feel like I grow a soul or I have a spirit that I discover, and only through this one act of thing, something I do. Maybe other people find it through prayer or through meditation or through different things that you can do, but they all have to be things that take you out of time, that take you somewhere other than the space that you occupy in your body with your ego in charge.
Right. So as you contemplate the songs you've written and wrote rather for Cruel Country, do you have any new, or I guess even just based on what you were saying, and I know this is a heavily used term, so I'm going to invoke therapeutic, because I'm just curious, like, do you, it's interesting to me that you said that you don't do those word ladders anymore, because I do think sometimes when you finish something, when you write a book like this, it's kind of out of your system, and your body mm-hmm. and your brain just evolve, you move past it. And I know you are in a weird spot as a songwriter, because you'll write a song or release a song in 2002 that evokes feelings you had at the time, but then you have to sing it for the rest of your life, which is sort of weird.
I don't have to.
No, you don't have to. But no, yes, you do. Your fans demand it. But the fans always get what they want. No, my point is, you're just constantly like, I'm sure you must have songs where the emotion, like the original core emotion, was very powerful. And you've got to kind of relive it over and over again. Anyway, sorry. You know what I'm getting at there?
Yeah, but it's probably part of how I would ever come to the conclusion that the past isn't the past.
Yes.
You know, the past doesn't stop changing. And that's probably in some part through that experience of having my songs that theoretically should be moving along with time in the same direction, all like never varying from, you know, their origin, but they do. They feel prescient sometimes. They feel like completely wrong to who I am sometimes, but in a way that's interesting and fascinating to sing because I don't have to be who I was to sing a song to somebody. They change in the way that people react to them. I can complete the circuit for somebody that, like, by singing Jesus, etc., for the 50,000th time or something like that.
Yeah.
And it may not be moving me at that moment, but seeing it move somebody else puts it in that present, you know?
You know, it's interesting you brought up Jesus, etc., and prescience. You remember this. So Yankee Hotel Foxtrot comes out 2002. After 9/11, and people thought it was like they seemed to be singing about something like stuff that happened during 9/11, which was odd. But it brings me to my latest theory that I've been throwing at everyone who'll be on my show, which is that I think musicians are often, prescience is often foisted upon songwriters and poets and whatnot, because they'll say a thing and then something happens and then people go back to what they said, or rather, sometimes in your case, the record comes out after, and then people are trying to make sense of something recent. So they go, oh my God, they were onto something. My theory is that artists are maybe a little more dialed into reality than the general public. And so they're picking up on stuff, whatever, subconsciously, whatever, and they're writing it down or they're conveying it in a song. And then in some sort of weird sci-fi trick, it comes true or becomes more apparent to everyone else. Because they don't give maybe their life or my life doesn't offer me the opportunity to sit down and kind of convey those feelings and thoughts, because my life or most lives are just a blur. But the artist can kind of have that moment of, I'm working on something. I'm trying to talk about the human experience. So what I'm getting at is, I'm not saying soothsaying, but it's sort of like, it is prescience, but it's something else. I just think there may be tapped into something more underground that isn't prevalent. Does any of that make any sense? Is that is that wild?
Well, as much as I would love to agree with that seems like an almost, you know, somewhat exalted idea of something that artists do are capable of. And I'm not discounting your theory at all that maybe there's a but you know, I mean, most people I know that write songs, make art, are pretty empathetic. They spend a lot of time thinking about the world. They spend a lot of time in solitude. They spend, you know, they're potentially things that might tune them into certain wavelengths that we're not all paying attention to all the time. Having said all that, I think the much more believable explanation for that than anything else is the fact that artists actually put all of those thoughts out into the world and therefore have a bigger pool of things to choose from for bias confirmation about how, you know, I don't have much evidence. Well, actually, I mean, your show is based on conversation and it has, you know, it's not that open to interpretation. The conversation is what the conversation is. A song is just music alone could seem prescient.
Yeah.
You know, like without any words, you could make something and it's so subjective that somebody in a completely raw, heartbroken state could say, oh my God, how did they see that this was going to happen, you know, to me? And everybody, unfortunately, has been going through a lot of periods recently, a lot of those same type of feelings, the feelings that we associate with being in a breakup or like, yeah, like this heartbroken state.
Yeah.
This feeling of betrayal, this, you know, sort of sadness about the state of the world.
Yeah.
And in that state, especially when people turn to art, to turn the radio on, turn anywhere, they're likely to find something that feels meaningful.
Yeah. No. And that,
and
yeah,
I mean, it's because you need it, because you absolutely need it. And our brains are meaning seeking, like machines, pattern seeking machines. We just want that to make sense. And God, it would feel so good to just know that some of us have the ability to kind of feel it before it happens.
If you're dialed into the human condition, you might be you could potentially be a little bit ahead of your time, is maybe where I'm coming from. Like, you might be onto things that people just don't have the time to think about. So I appreciate what you're saying in terms of deferring it as too exalted, but I think I didn't put it forward maybe in the most cogent way, but it's clumsy, but I think my theory has legs. It's stumbling about.
Well, let's do a little thought experiment.
Sure.
There's also the fact that people value art that has some root in trauma. That is introspecting or examining a sad feeling, examining heartache, examining a lot of the art that we revere and think of as being more valuable than other art is the art that has taken the time to kind of explain that to ourselves or make ourselves feel at least seen in those feelings. So let's look at art that doesn't do that. Nobody's going to listen to Love Shack by the B-52s and think, oh my God, how did they know that I was going to have a Love Shack at some point? No, like this totally how did they know about bouncy castles? There's no way that they didn't even exist in that era, you know?
Fair. Yeah.
I don't know what I'm getting at. I'm just saying that those feelings don't get it. They don't get examined. They're just not, it's not as important. It's not as much a part of the need of or the function that it provides.
It's interesting because I think I see what you're getting at. When someone deals with something that has a cheery exterior, you're not going to think too much about it, overthink it maybe.
Right.
Right. Whereas if something is framed to you as being about pain, you want to try, again, negative bias. I think it's true. Our brains just go to the, okay, well, that's deep and meaningful. This is trite because it's not dealing with trauma, even though who knows why the person needs a love shack. Maybe they had their heart broke. That's probably why they want a love shack. They went through a rough breakup. Maybe this is the wrong reading of love shack. I'm sorry.
I think the love shack only exists for fun. And for there to be a moment where you're free of burden.
Yeah, I think I agree. I want to get back to this last question about the Cruel Country. What I was getting at is, as you've finished writing the songs and contemplate them, do you have any new or therapeutic, I guess is the word I was looking for, perspectives on America, your place in America, its place in the world? because I feel like as I go through the lyrics, there is this sense of place, how we relate mm-hmm. to other people around the world. You have a song. Mm-hmm. I'm paraphrasing one of your songs right now about people all across the world. But do you have any feelings about America as we're speaking today, which is June 1st, 2022? Do you have any feelings about it, having written this batch of songs? Or rather, feelings that have changed you or altered you or your perspective on you, your country, where it's at right now?
I mean, I really, I'm miserable at how, about how little talent there seems to be for communication in our leaders, and the world to me would be a better place if we were able to have discussions that weren't around rhetoric and where like there was like some situation where we could get back to some idea of there being a future worth striving for, you know, an agreed upon commitment to making things better as a, and fixing problems. I don't feel like there is a time in our history I would prefer to go back to, because I think there is nostalgia on the left and the right, and neither one of them seems to be picturing the past accurately, and certainly not for everyone. You know, we act like this is new. It's nothing new. None of it is new. None of the rancor, none of the divisions are new. None of it is new. What is new to me is the complicating nature of social media and the climate of how we communicate, making it almost impossible to hear each other. That's new. I think that here's... I'm sorry. You want to have something to say?
No, Do I? I look like I'm being rude and wanting to talk, but I'm actually listening.
I'm
just deeply. I'm trying to ponder what you're saying.
I'm wanting a life raft. I'm like, when are you going to throw me a life?
Well, preserver? Okay, I will, because this was striking that you said. You kept saying how things weren't new. That this mm-hmm. is so. What you're saying is like we're in a cycle. And I was today reading the press release about the reissue for Yankee Hotel Foxtrot. When's that coming out again, Jeff? Sorry, I didn't read the press release closely enough, apparently.
Sometime in September.
So in September. On the Nonesuch site today, I was reading it, and just in the context of pondering the songs on Cruel Country. And there's a passage that quotes repeat guest on this show, Bob Mayer, who's been on 3 or 4 times to talk about The Replacements. He wrote the liners for Yankee Hotel Foxtrot. Is this correct?
Yes.
The reissue, I mean. So I just want to read something to you. Quote, conceptually, Tweedy had decided to focus on a big idea for the next album, the state of America. His lyrics, often distilled from scribbled pages of free verse or poetry, become a form of inquiry, Mayer says. Tweedy said in 2004, I wanted to write about the stuff right in front of my eyes, microscopically looking at America and asking questions about each little thing. How can there be all these good things and things that I love about America alongside all these things that I'm ashamed of? And that was an internal question, too. I think I felt that way about myself, end quote. All I'm getting at is this seems very similar to what the context is for this record.
Oh, I don't think it's anything. I mean, I listened like when we played a set at Solid Sound the first night we played Cruel Country in its entirety. And it was the first time, maybe the only time we'll ever play it in one set. And then the next night we put together a set with, you know, from all the different records in our career. And there were so many songs that we were playing when I was thinking, oh, this would have fit in on Cruel Country if I ever was a child, or I don't know, just like it's not an, I mean, it's an underlying obsession possibly.
Well, I think it speaks to you and your consistency as an artist and a person, mm-hmm. a person who thinks about things a certain way. Like that's what stuck out for me more than, like, obviously, why I just broached it just now is because I think it speaks to what you're saying. Like, this is just a cycle of behavior that has clearly influenced, like, sorry, the environment you're in has not really changed exactly in 20 years. Like, the things you're concerned about and thinking about are the same. I don't think
they've changed in my lifetime, to be honest. Right, I think that 67, 68, the Democratic National Convention, you know, like the divisions are like my only experience of this country have been around these specific divisions, race divisions where I grew up. I grew up next to East St. Louis, Illinois, which was one of the most impoverished communities in North America, in a solidly, you know, working class, lower middle class factory town that basically looked at its police force as a border patrol with our neighboring community of East St. Louis. Mm-hmm. So like I grew up in the belly of that conflict, and it's troubled me my whole life. It really makes me very, very, very sad. I think it's so dumb. So it's maddeningly dumb. And the thing that at the same time as furious as I get at the simplicity of the problem, and it also gives me hope, because the answers are so unbelievably clear. And to me, and to everyone, I think if everyone, honestly, I think there are lots of people on the other side that understand the answers just as well as I do. Hmm. And it's not like these are problems. There are many, many problems that this country has. There are many problems that are everywhere in the world that you live. Every society has political problems and cultural problems and things that they need to figure out and solve and do better. But some problems are just so clear how simple they would be to fix that I just can't allow myself to believe that they won't be fixed.
I
just don't see how that center holds forever, that you just can deny the answer. Yeah.
It's very difficult to, I appreciate your optimism, but like, I don't know what it would take for your country to change, like objectively as a Canadian. And we're not great here either, but we don't have as much access to horrible shit that your folks do. And we are still reconciling our own history of racism and bigotry. Mm-hmm. And so we have a lot of work to do. So I'm not saying this from any exalted, to use your earlier word, point of view, but I've asked this of a couple of people before. Steve Albini once told me he had his eye on New Zealand as a place to live, but he doesn't know what the hell he'd do down in New Zealand. Do you ever get to the point, Jeff, where you're like, I can't, what are we doing? Like, where could, what, why are we living here? Like, do you ever get that low?
I've been everywhere, or like most places, not everywhere, but I've been a lot of places, and I haven't really gone anywhere where there aren't historical problems. I haven't gone any places where I can't picture some of the problems that we have arising if they aren't there now. I feel like in a position of privilege in this country as a successful white man, I should be able to move forward with at least enough, as much courage in my love and my convictions as I've witnessed in people that don't have that privilege and don't have that status. And this country has become better for most of the changes that have made this country better have been through the courage, like just unbelievable courage of people that didn't have what I have. So for me to bail, it seems very cowardly. And I always think my kids think that would be like the worst thing in the world to do is to leave our community and leave basically the people that we could potentially help behind and save our own asses or something like that. And I don't believe Steve for a second. I know Steve pretty well. I don't think he would ever do that either. And I'm not, I mean, we do what we can, but
yeah.
You know, the specific thing I was talking about is the idea of gun control in this country. You know, people think.
Yeah, I thought so. I thought that's what you're talking about.
That's one thing. That's one issue. I mean, racism isn't unique to the United States. It's problematic all over the world.
It's reported on with more prevalent, like it's a complicated situation from my perspective, because the more you talk to marginalized people in Canada, or they write their books, you read about stuff the media doesn't cover here. They just haven't decided to cover it. And on the one hand, that's erasure, but on another, then I watch CNN and it feels like it's sensationalism. However, it's the truth. It's very confusing. Like, I think you're more hyper aware of your differences based on how the media chooses to. Sorry, I keep saying the media like a idiot, but you know what I mean? Like, I feel like you live, if you pay attention to your news cycles, you're going to be hyper aware of the difference that is being foisted upon you as people. Whereas I think this record, a lot of it to me is about how we're all kind of the same wherever we are.
Yeah.
That's simplistic maybe, but it does try to humanize the experience of living on this planet as a shared experience. So
this is maybe why I say, talk to me. I don't want to hear poetry. I want to hear, say it plain the way you really speak. The lyric you quoted earlier, because I just don't know how anybody knows anything. And the thing that only thing that I can use to calibrate myself and keep myself coming back to some sense of optimism and some sense of humanity is to center myself back in the idea that I don't know everything. I don't know very much. And I'm not the person people are looking to solve problems on a global scale.
Yeah.
What my responsibility is to my community and refocus myself on what I'm actually capable of doing. And some of that is like very feeble, you know, it's like, it's just like, it's making songs, making something beautiful, putting it out in the world. I consider that among the things that I can do.
Well, I fully agree. I don't think fleeing one's community. I think actually, yes, strengthening and bolstering your community, specifically like your community where you live, that's the first step. It's why people used to make fun of me for having local sponsors on this podcast. Or I always do a thing where I suggest to people that they support a couple of organizations. And my hope is that someone listening to that in Louisiana isn't like, why would I donate to that Alberta organization that helps black women? My hope is that they'll be like, oh, I have an organization like that in my community. So I'm going to support that because of this guy's stupid podcast made me think to do that. That's your hope, is that you make little incremental change, but it spreads. You have this platform where I think you're doing that, but you get to tour the world.
Yeah.
And your music reaches outside of your community. So salute you for that.
Well, everywhere we go, we do like tour poster proceeds go to a local charity. We try and consider the band as a citizen of every individual city we travel to. Not exactly for what you're saying. Not that we're going to come roll through town and solve all your problems. It means something to have those communities or those organizations acknowledge, and they also like remind the people that actually live in those communities that they exist, you know, in some cases. But I'm very, very opinionated about a lot of things in terms of how I wish the world would be.
Yes.
But having grown up in a family with people that I would absolutely hate if they weren't my family, just based on some of their convictions and their beliefs growing up.
Yeah.
I feel compelled to maintain some space for evolution, you know, some sort of epiphany or some sort of, you know, moment. And then actually, to be honest, that comes from experience too, because I saw it happen with my dad. I saw my dad become a different person in the years before he died. And some of it was, he worked on the railroad his whole life. And he fucking hated Donald Trump. And you want to know why he hated Donald Trump? Donald Trump was the boss's kid. That Donald Trump was, my dad was so smart. He couldn't go to the local bar anymore because they were playing Fox News. And he couldn't take the way it was radicalizing some people in his neighborhood, you know? And so he leaned on me a lot more than he ever did his entire life. He became more connected to me as like a life raft of somebody saying, I see what you see, Dad, you know? Mm-hmm. And this was not a man that you would have agreed with in many arguments about anything regarding the topics we're talking about when I was growing up.
Right.
But you know, the epiphany for him was Donald Trump calling Mexicans rapists, and demonizing people that were coming to this country. My dad called me crying, saying that he would have crawled across the desert with me on his back if it was what he had to do to take care of me. And I believe him, but it was a moment of empathy where he was actually, it's just like, just hit him.
Yeah.
That's what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Those are the people we're talking about and calling these names. And so I always like that probably does give me a distorted sense of hope, because not everybody is going to have that moment of empathy, that clear moral moment, but it exists and it can happen.
It's possible.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jeff, I appreciate this conversation. This is much longer than I usually go with anyone. I apologize.
Talk too much.
No, I do too. I had lots of ideas, and I've listened to your record on a loop in the house with my children and my wife, and it's been wonderful. I just wanted to quasi apologize if I've kept you too long. But I feel like it's been enjoyable.
Absolutely.
That's my read.
Even if you don't get a candygram from me. Afterwards, now you're I just want me, you to know I've really enjoyed this speech.
I probably shouldn't have invoked all of the stuff I invoked. I'm being raw and honest about it, because it just means the world to me. When it's, you know what? Let's not revisit it. I think you're the same. It means a lot to you to hear from someone that engages for sure with your work in a positive way. Indifference is worse than almost anything else, I guess, is the moral of the story. Indifference feels like, what happened?
Oh.
He had no reaction.
The worst, worst review you can possibly get is three letters. Meh.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Anyway, I'm fine. I'm very fine. It's so thrilling to have a guest like you on the show. I don't care what else happens after this. This was fun and interesting to me. Now, before we go, I did mention Yankee Hotel Foxtrot. And that's coming up in the fall. We obviously talked about this new record, Cruel Country, that's out now. Is there anything about Yankee Hotel Foxtrot or anything else you want to talk about in terms of upcoming stuff that people should know about? And within that, where would you like, I assume wilcoworld.com is where you go? Is that the?
Yeah.
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 Yeah. But is there anything you want to talk about in terms of upcoming stuff or this very elaborate Yankee Hotel Foxtrot box set?
I would like to address some of the things I saw about the rollout of that box set.
Oh, please do.
I saw some people blaming us for the vinyl shortage because there's an 11 disc box set. And I just wanted to let everybody know that we've been in line for 20 years for that.
I appreciate that. Yeah. Ever since that's a reflex that's occurring. I'm seeing it more and more among artists and fans saying, like, what the hell? What do you have a take on it? Like, I know, I get it. I see where you're coming from, but yeah, I guess that was a hot topic. What's your take on that?
Oh, it's a drag. It's a drag for everybody. I mean, but in all seriousness, that record has been, it's been being planned for at least 3 or 4 years. So it's not like we jumped the line and said, hey, let's press up a like 11 record box set out of the blue.
Yeah.
We've been in the queue for longer than almost anybody.
Is it done? Is it like, this is the other thing I keep seeing is people, well, it's happening less. I think people are learning not to announce before they physically have the thing because there's all these delays. Do you guys have the thing now? Is it done?
I mean, the record is sequenced, all the mastering is done, all of that. I'm not sure where the production, the actual manufacturing stands to be honest. Okay. I mean, I don't have a copy of it, but that's not unusual.
I think people can read about all the stuff that's on it in terms of the extras. There's a lot of extra stuff. Obviously, it's 11 records. For you, are there particular highlights or revelations that you're excited about sharing? Because it's a very process-oriented collection from what I've read, really taking people through the journey of the making of those songs. But is there something you're really particularly excited about sharing with that thing?
Yeah, there's the version of Ashes of American Flags that was going to be on the record, which we had to remix at the last minute. There's a Stravinsky piece that goes through the entirety of it from Symphony of Psalms. At the time, I was listening to and educating myself on modern composition and things like that, because it was just a world that it was very alien to me and exciting to try and piece together what its movements were and, you know, and who the major players were and things like that. So I was listening to some Stravinsky and thinking, my God, this is what I want to do, but I don't have the vocabulary or the training to do this. And I took the track in because I knew it was in the same key. And I asked Jim O'Rourke, I was like, I would like for this to be on this song, something like this. How do we get this to work? And I said, can we just like put this over it and just see if it works? Just see if it gives you any ideas of some arrangement we could do or something like that. And we ended up loving just having this almost like a Charles Ives thing. There's two completely different. There's the track of Ashes of American Flags, and there's the Stravinsky portion going over the entirety of it. And it lines up in all of these incredible places and has this this conversation between the two pieces is just miraculous to me. And then we couldn't get clearance from the Stravinsky estate. And then we finally got clearance for this box set. So I'm really excited to finally get to share that with everyone.
Well, I appreciate that insight. I didn't know about this, and I'm looking forward to hearing that as well. That's great. So yeah, as far as you can tell, that's out in September. I'm sorry, I don't have that information at the ready, but I'll link to everything in the podcast description. People can go to Wilco's website. Tour dates and stuff coming up too, right?
Sounds right.
probably. Like, you guys have been fairly busy, I feel like.
No, we definitely have some dates coming up, and we have some dates in Canada, I'm pretty sure. But I would be hard-pressed to put them out there accurately.
No, and I didn't expect you to. Again, I'll link to everything. So, that's pretty much all that info. If we can go out on a song from Cruel Country, I wonder if you can pick one for us, Jeff, and also tell us why you chose it.
I think maybe I would go with Country Song Upside Down, just because it's a live take. The whole thing is live with the band, and it's so lush and beautiful to me that we can all point ourselves in that direction and make something like that as a band.
Real quick, nothing's real quick with you and me, but real quick, because I wanted to ask about it and I got lost in all our other conversations. So Wilco reconvened after some time apart to make this record, right? I don't know how long it had been before you all were in the same room. Do you remember?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, we had done some touring, you know, tours that were basically all makeup touring from previous scheduled tours that had kept getting pushed back because of the pandemic and rescheduled. But it'd probably been about 2 years, almost exactly.
Okay. Between,
between us getting to be in the same studio space together recording.
Do you ever, and that's an unusually long time, I would guess, for the band to be apart?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, that's probably the longest.
Did you have any feeling of like, anytime you take a break and come back, do you ever think, are we still going to be able to do it? Do we still got it? Do you ever have that just moment of like, what's this going to be like? We haven't done this in usually probably 5 months, but now 2 years. Because I feel the joy in you guys. The fact that you chose to record this way, live, off the floor, suggests a sort of communal celebration. Let's be in the rooms together. No baffles, no nothing. for the most part. So it feels celebratory in that regard. But did you have a second of like, all right, we got to get used to each other again? Is it, how's this going to work?
It's like, no, I mean, I know the feeling you're talking about. Maybe when I was younger, I used to feel like it was a burden to start to have so many songs to keep in my head. You know, when we started making more and more records, maybe around the fourth or fifth record, I started being fearful that was just too much for my mind to keep mm-hmm. that repertoire of songs going all the time. And that if we stopped touring too long, I would forget how to play everything and maybe even forget how to play my instrument. Mm-hmm. And that never happened. And over time, I think I started letting go of those fears and having a lot more confidence in the ability for it to come back. And at this point, I think this band, that's one of the reasons it's joyous, is it is like riding a bike. There's a familiarity with each other, even after a long break. It is a family. Mm-hmm. It has the conversational ease that a good friend has after not seeing them for a long time. You don't have to catch up on everything. You just automatically start feeling like you did when you last saw that person. And I'm like that with my sister. I'm sure you have people in your life that you're like that with. Mm-hmm. It's not one of those situations where you have to go, why were we friends? You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's pretty clear why we like being together, and it comes back really fast.
It's nice to hear, because it's certainly I've been so fortunate when I lived in Ontario. Now I live in Alberta, but in Ontario, I would see Wilco all the time, every time mm-hmm. I could, and always really meaningful to me. It's really one of the greatest bands I've ever seen. And I did a count. I've seen 3 billion bands. So I'm comparing it to that. Oh, yeah. So I want to thank you for being in Wilco and for continuing to make these great records and books and all the stuff you do, Jeff. It's just a wonderful life you've led. And I'm pleased to be peripherally involved. So yes, without further ado, because I'm just rambling here like a weirdo, I want to play yep. you all a new song by Wilco called Country Song Upside Down from their beautiful and majestic new record, Cruel Country. Jeff Tweedy, thank you so much for being back on the show and for giving me any time, let alone all this time. Thank you so much. It means the world.
Thank you, Vish. Honestly, really wonderful time. I'm really, I feel lucky I get to talk about this stuff with anybody, and especially somebody is thoughtful and I don't know, willing to just go there with me. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Song upside down, a country song, like a trout, dying sky and water, rainbow flickering out inside a dark cabin. More moonlight I become, rounding all of my edges, some weight can't be sung. Like this. upside down country song. Without a doubt, dying sky, water, rainbow, flickering out.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, thanks once again to Jeff Tweedy for being back on this show to talk about Wilco. And, you know, I can't be objective. I feel like I was a little too emo and open about some of my insecurities. But whatever, I think you talk to Jeff, and that's what happens. You both get open. Anyway, I apologize. Actually, I bet people listening can tell me if this was any more open and insecure than I normally sound. But anyway, I really enjoyed this chat. You learn from expressing your insecurity, I hope. I feel like I did. Anyway, thank you so much again, Jeff, for being back on the show, this time for the 692nd episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One Podcast Network and is available wherever you get your podcasts. If you can't find an episode that you've heard about and you're looking for it everywhere, you're turning over rocks, you're like, where is it? I don't know where it is. Or if you want to learn more about me and sign up for my monthly newsletter, everything you need should be on my website there, vishkhanna.com. You can also like Creative Control on Facebook or follow the show on Twitter at vishcreative, or you can follow me directly on Twitter and on Instagram at vishkhanna. Also, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to sustain this podcast, all the work that I put into this thing. This is the Patreon's the primary source of revenue for any of it. And it's modest, but I'm very proud of all of the work, and I'm very pleased and overwhelmed with the gratitude from people like you who listen and take time out of your day to go to the patreon.com/creativecontrol and make a flexible monthly donation. It's really, really kind. I won't lie to you. Some days it really keeps me going, and it's encouragement, and I appreciate it. $6 or more a month grants you access to exclusive content. That some of it's derived from these current and new interviews. Some of it I grab from my audio archives, from the interviews I've done preceding the launch of this podcast. So please consider supporting the show. And if you're interested in receiving a Creative Control T-shirt, just message me on Patreon and I will get you one while supplies last and just as soon as is humanly possible. Patreon.com/creativecontrol for more info. Thanks again to the fine Alberta record retailer Blackbird Music, which is located in Edmonton and Calgary, Alberta. You can learn more about them and order stuff at blackbird.ca. Also want to thank Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario for their in-kind support for this show. Thanks, as always, to my good buddy Jim Guthrie for letting me use some music of his on this show. You can learn more about Jim at jimguthrie.org. And finally, thank you for listening to this episode with Jeff Tweedy from Wilco. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you consider subscribing to the podcast or following it and telling your friends all about it and spreading the word about it. It means a lot. Thank you. I enjoyed this one. It means a lot to me. I hope you enjoyed it. Talk to you soon. Bye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.